Hello, welcome to episode 11 of the Bitcoin Game. I'm Rob Mitchell. I'm here at GEM headquarters in Venice Beach, California, for a Los Angeles Bitcoin meetup with a presentation from Paul Pui called How Bitcoin Will Revolutionize Mobile Payments. I'm sure Paul will also talk a bit about the Airbits mobile wallet, and at the end he's supposed to answer some questions. Paul has a visual presentation he'll be giving during this talk, so if you want to follow along with that, just find this episode's page on letstalkbitcoin.com.
Hey guys, I don't know if everyone here knows me. I'm Micah Winkle-Specht. I'm the CEO and founder of GEM, which is the office that you're at right now. So welcome to our home. I got involved in the Bitcoin community here back in, a couple of years ago. And this group was really, really tiny. I see a lot of familiar faces now, so we have quite a strong repeat visitor group here. We basically went from like 15, 30 people coming to events to now we actually had to cap our event tonight just so that we could slide under the radar and not have to get event permits, but don't tell anybody. Sorry. So, you know, it's just been really, really exciting to see. I'm actually not speaking tonight, so I just wanted to welcome you guys. We're actually really lucky here to have a good friend of mine, Paul Pui, who is the CEO and founder of a wallet company called Airbits, based down in San Diego. And Paul and I, you know, Paul is probably one of the strongest philosophical voices, I would say, in Bitcoin. Really a true believer in the technology and its ability to enable true private interactions and transactions with each other. And his product really reflects those philosophies. So it's interesting because it's, you know, in fairly stark contrast to some of the other different types of wallets that are out there where privacy kind of just went straight out the window immediately. And we've had many different deep conversations everywhere from Amsterdam to Las Vegas at different Bitcoin conferences. So I'm really excited to have him visit us here. He's part of the Plug and Play Accelerator up in San Francisco and made his trek down here to talk to us. So with that, I will introduce Paul.
All right, 1 second, guys. Just switching over to our slides here. Okay, thanks so much for the introduction, Micah. We have gone through quite a bit over the past year. I actually met Micah over a year ago at the Vegas conference, and both of our companies were in very different positions at the time, and it's been really exciting to see where Bitcoin has come in that period. Like you said, we do, both I and our company, hold the fundamental tenets of Bitcoin at heart: decentralization, privacy, and autonomy. But today, what I'm going to talk about, for the most part, is going to be about Bitcoin as a mobile payment platform. And a lot of people think that we are moving towards mobile payments, and I do think that we are, and moving away from plastic and whatnot. But let's see what we're trying to move towards and how Bitcoin can revolutionize, once again, mobile payments, where many companies have failed. Square, Google, PayPal, and even with the advent of the exciting and multi-billion dollar backed Apple Pay, how Apple will probably fail as well. So let's talk a little bit about that. So quick introductions. I am Paul Pui, CEO and co-founder of Airbits. And I was into Bitcoin not super early, probably in about April of 2013. And before that, I worked at NVIDIA at Chromatic Research. I did visual computing and also worked in small business. I was the guy on the other side of the counter getting reamed with credit card fees and chargebacks. It was a big 180 in life to see things from a non-technical point of view, but also to see the interface between merchants and consumers. And even before Bitcoin, how that was really nascent, and we didn't really build great technology, and I wanted to innovate in that respect. But when Bitcoin came around, it gave me that opportunity to innovate, but at the same time, to really revolutionize an industry that needed it to begin with the financial industry. So let's go back down the history of payments. Let's actually just go way, way, way back, about 3,000 years ago, way back. And these are cowrie shells. And about 3,000 years ago, they were used in China to actually transact. Let's not so much consider the cowrie shells as a currency. Think of it more as a payment network. And as a payment network, it was simple. It was physical. I took a bag of shells and I handed it over to another person in exchange for some good, some chickens, some fish, whatnot, some rice. And that was our payment network. There was no third party, but it was inconvenient. A very large number of shells were required to transact a very small amount of value because the shells were readily available. And so, as we see in technology, this was a technology and we needed to innovate in order for mankind to progress. And so what was kind of our next major innovation? Precious metals and gold. So with the advent of precious metals, we realized that we could now transact a larger amount of value with less weight and less energy. And we'll see that this is what we've been doing over the past many, many years, is making the transfer of value more efficient. So this roughly got started around 600 BC versus 3,000 years ago, and it continues on to today, although for the most part, we're just using gold as a store of value and as a trinket and for jewelry. Now, the thing that we all love to hate, good old paper fiat money, and at its roots, it was about 100 BC where this was actually present in China in the form of leather strips, but really paper money didn't become popular until probably 1,000, 1,300 BC in Europe. And as we had seen in the evolution of payments, this made money transfer even more efficient. Disregard how crappy a currency it is, but the transfer of money became much more efficient. Now with a very light amount of weight, we could transfer an even larger amount of value than gold. We just simply put the number on the piece of paper and then transfer it. Next evolution, checks. Now we're able to transfer almost an infinite number of value, so long as the bank account would actually uphold it. We simply write the value right on that piece of paper and transfer it. And this was actually technology used for quite some time. It's funny, I think Andreas Antonopoulos, in his talk, had mentioned the frustration of standing behind an old grandma writing a check at a grocery store, thinking, my God, where is she at? But we still do this today. And shockingly, what I still can't figure out is why this is one of the most free methods of transferring money from one bank account to another. Whereas if you do it digitally, it typically will cost you money. And where we are today with credit cards. So the first implementation of our credit cards, what we actually call like charge cards or charga cards or charge coins, these have been around since about the late 1800s and early 1900s. And the way they were first implemented was really mainly by merchants that had regularly occurring customers that they knew and they trusted, and they would stamp their name and maybe an account number onto this metal plate or a coin, hand it to them, and then they would have an internal ledger that they would debit whenever the customer came in, similar to a credit card. But it was very, I wouldn't really call it centralized, but it was very specific between a very specific merchant and a very specific customer. Not everyone had access to it, and not every merchant accepted it or even offered the service. Big thing happened in 1950. A more open platform came out with like Carte Blanche or Diners Club, where now, for the first time, a platform enabled multiple merchants to utilize the same charge mechanism. But the real big revolution actually came in 1958, and it's almost scary to think that we've been using this same technology since 1958, which is when Visa came out. And it was created by Bank of America, initially called Bank AmeriCard. But it was the first platform that actually allowed multiple banks to issue these cards and multiple merchants to issue the card as well. And that's when this entire ecosystem really started blowing up, and we're still using it today. So that's kind of a little bit of a walk down the history of payments. And now we're going to ask, what's the big question is what's next? And you can see on the bottom left is the big question is, you know, is it going to be mobile payments? Is that the next thing we're going to use, or are we just going to mentally communicate and tell people that we owe them money? We do think it's mobile payments. So let's ask our questions of why, and why have they failed so far? Many companies have tried to innovate and push mobile payments. PayPal's tried, Google has tried. Obviously, you have Apple Pay. They're kind of the big elephant in the room. There's Isis Mobile Wallet, if anyone has actually heard of this company. It's, at this point, a really terrible name, and I think they're changing the name of the company. Currency, and of course, Square. And I have a handful of these wallets, and I've actually tried to use them, being a Bitcoiner that, you know, enjoys mobile payments. But I found that they have definitely not been adopted to the degree that we'd all hope. And why? One big reason is very, very likely fragmentation. If I go to a merchant that takes PayPal, another merchant might choose to take Google Wallet, and I will have to have these two implementations on my phone. It's a fairly closed ecosystem, and they're very, very fragmented. So there isn't a good standard across all of these, and they can't really agree, and they're all very competitive. An example of that competitive nature is a lot of people have probably heard, I'm sure many of you have heard, of the competition between Apple Pay and currency. Some handful of merchants are fine supporting Apple Pay, and some say, no, we don't want to get screwed with those fees. We're going to create our own. And now we have this huge fragmentation because they can't agree. So let's talk a little about Apple Pay. And, you know, everyone thinks that that is the big potential in mobile payments. Well, if you think it's a big potential in mobile payments, realize one fact is that it's a small fraction of the entire global ecosystem of mobile. And, you know, in 2014, like this says, 85% of the devices shipped were on Android. And none of those devices have any capability of running Apple Pay. And from the viewpoint of trust, from the viewpoint of trust, there's a little meme here about Apple securing your financial information with potentially the same security that they secure your photos and whatnot, which may have leaked out a while ago. So Apple Pay, although exciting and backed by a ton of money, doesn't appear to be the thing that's going to drive the adoption. And I'm pretty sure, without knowing exact numbers, that its usage hasn't really been what I'd call outstanding. So fragmentation is one key thing that's potentially holding back a lot of this mobile payment adoption. What could be another is, well, potentially centralization. In the same sense of fragmentation, a lot of the choices when using a mobile payment platform create an aspect of centralization. You're having to go through a central authority, both from the consumer side and from the provider side. So if I want to accept like PayPal, I have to go to PayPal to accept it, and I have to have their wallet. So if we look back and compare all of these methods of payment, we'll notice somewhat of a trend. And you know, everything all the way back to cowrie shells, to where we are today, we'll notice that the most successful methods of payment have an aspect of decentralization. Maybe not the currency, because obviously we use paper money, and that's not really decentralized, but the payment mechanism is. So the physical payment methods, which are the three on the top, the shells, the gold, the paper money, never had a third-party intermediary. I never had to go through a third person to make that payment. And even the two payments in the bottom right, so when I wrote a check, and there were initially bank checks that were very limited in scope, and that this check was only good for this one bank, and you couldn't transfer between the two. But they really started blowing up in the 1900s when there was standardization between different banks. So I can write a check from one bank, and a different bank would cash it. And that small little nugget of decentralization, as much as I hate to associate any banks with decentralization, that small nugget is what helped launch checks. And the same thing with credit cards. In 1958, when they finally allowed multiple banks to issue a card and multiple payment processors to process it, that's when that payment network launched. So why haven't we been able to get this done with mobile payments? So there's what I call the kind of good enough problem, and we have this in many aspects of life. One aspect is that car that you have sitting in your garage that, you know, the bumper's fallen off and maybe one of the lights is kind of dim and the seats aren't very comfy. You know, the seal's pretty bad and you can hear the wind when you're driving, but it's kind of good enough. That's kind of what we have with this 1958 Civic, which really is a 1958 credit card. You know, it's fast enough for some transactions. It kind of works for the internet, even though it wasn't built for it. And it's pretty ubiquitous. It's in a lot of places. And, you know, some places it's even required. I know a lot of airlines will require you to pay for their snacks with a credit card. Can't pay cash anymore. So that's the good enough problem. And a lot of these mobile payment platforms aren't really innovating on top of just being good enough. They're taking good enough and they are basically turning them into tricked out credit cards. They're taking that beat up Civic in your car, in your garage, and then putting a spoiler on it and giving it a weird little paint job and calling it the Square Up Wallet. Or they're putting a really, really big spoiler on it and then calling it like Google Wallet and saying this is the cool new thing. Or what car isn't complete without a flaming green paint job and calling that, what did I say, PayPal Wallet. And of course, the granddaddy of them all, the one with the flipping doors and spinning trunk and whatnot, and you call that, you know, Apple Pay. But in the end, they're all still that old beat up Civic Accord that's been in your garage potentially since 1958. So what are we trying to build, though? We're trying to build the next evolution. We're trying to build kind of like the Tesla of payments, something that's really taking new technology that we haven't seen before and pushing that. And same way the automotive industry is getting revolutionized by Tesla. We're trying to revolutionize payments with Bitcoin. And so what are the big advantages of Bitcoin? How can it do what these other mobile payment platforms haven't been able to do? It has two big things going for it. We talked a lot about decentralization, definitely has that. And it also has one really big thing, which I call is the evangelism. So let's look at the decentralization aspect of it. So Bitcoin is an open platform. Unlike PayPal, Square, Google, Apple Pay, you can choose. This is the beauty of it. I'm a wallet provider, our company is a wallet provider, but we're fully intercompatible with other wallets, and we're compatible with any payment processor. So looking at this Bitcoin network, you could choose any wallet on the left as a consumer, and choose any of the payment processors on the right if they service your region as a merchant. And it's even more open than that, because you don't have to go from consumer to merchant. You can go from consumer to consumer, merchant to merchant, merchant to consumer, merchant back to, you name it. All the combinations are possible. It is the most open platform we've had since physical money. And nothing that we're trying to push, at least nothing that the establishment is trying to push, has this level of openness. And then the big thing that I don't think any of these other companies can compare to is the evangelism. All of you are here today because you're interested in or passionate about or trying to learn about Bitcoin. I don't think PayPal Wallet has any meetup of this size. And this isn't even one of the largest ones. There's like 100 people meet a month over at the San Francisco meetup, and 60 meet up every single week for developer technical chats. We have a huge, huge evangelism community and people that are going to these merchants and saying, hey, would you take Bitcoin? I did that just today, an hour ago. And maybe they say no once and twice and maybe three times. Maybe after the 30th, they say yes. And even though PayPal may have quite a number of employees and a marketing team that goes and pushes the usage of their platform, it's really hard to compete against thousands, tens, hundreds of thousands of people that really want this currency, which has a built-in payment platform, to succeed. And that's something that's really hard to fight. And these are just a few statistics on the adoption rate of Bitcoin and where it was. I think this was middle of last year. You've got 585 meetup groups around the world, over 68,000 members of those groups. And those are just members of the meetup groups. That doesn't count a lot of the people that are in the woodwork that, you know, don't go to the meetups. In over 300 cities in 72 countries, you know, and Reddit subscribers blew up from 2012 to 2014. We went from 11,000 to over 124,000. And recently, NCR, who's one of the longest standing point of sale system companies in the world, you know, launched their NCR Silver, which supports PayPal and supports Bitcoin. And they've had far, far more interest and inquiries and requests for the Bitcoin portion of that platform than they have had for the Apple Pay. I'm sorry, did I say PayPal? I meant Apple Pay. And so this is stuff that many of you probably have already heard, which applies as well for payments. Why accept them from a merchant point of view? Well, little or no merchant fees, no chargebacks, and I felt that myself as a small business owner and manager. Got a lot of chargebacks, especially because it was a bar nightclub. Free publicity, you know that as well. And then the Bitcoin advantage for consumers. Obviously, from the ideological point of view, if you don't want to be holding inflating currency, then there's lower inflation than most government currencies. And there's a chart of some of the top inflationary government currencies today. But then the big one, here's where we make Bitcoin actually valuable to even people in the developed countries, such as us with fairly stable currencies such as the dollar, is merchant discounts. I use these three companies on a regular basis. Gift, GYFT, and eGifter give you 3% back on gift cards, and two that I'm really excited about that are a little less known. Who's heard of Fold app in the group? One person, oh my gosh, you all are gonna be using Fold app by the end of this presentation. Or Purse.io, who's heard of Purse.io? Okay, good, quite a number of people. They were accelerated at plug and play like we are today. So Fold app is a simple app you can go to. It's a web app on your phone. You go there and you can buy a 5, 10, I think right now it's only 5, but they at one point would have $20 gift cards for right now just Starbucks. But you can buy it instantly and you get a barcode on your phone and you can spend that within like 30 seconds and then get the change returned into your Bitcoin wallet. And they give you 20% off on that gift card instantly. Amazing. And then purse.io, a little bit more friction, but as many of you know, you can purchase almost anything on Amazon at a starting at 8% if you're a new customer, upwards of 25% off. And that works by leveraging an entire ecosystem of people with Amazon gift cards in countries that don't have access to Bitcoin and don't have access to Amazon that are willing to take that price premium to buy Bitcoin on your behalf. So there's real good use need, and there's also a really good opportunity. And then, of course, as Mike had mentioned about myself and at Erbitz, there's also the aspect of privacy and, you know, global usability.
Today's magic word is mobile, M-O-B-I-L-E. Use the magic word to claim your share of this week's listener distribution of LTB coin on letstalkbitcoin.com.
So, cool. So what are we doing to kind of advance mobile payments in our company, Erbitz? So, one quick question. How many people have even heard of Erbitz? We're a fairly young company. Oh, just raise your hand. So, a handful. Cool. All right. Not 100% new to it. Well, hopefully we hit some people that are fairly new to Erbitz, but if you guys want to look under your seat, there's a handful of gift cards in some of the seats, and they're usually at the ones closest that are for people that are less scared of being so close to the stage. There should be one taped under a handful of the seats. Anyone find one, or did I just lie? Cool, there's one right there. Cool. And the second one. So there's 15 millibit on those cards. So if you'd like to go and download Erbitz at the end of the presentation or whatnot, you could sweep that key and you get it. If you're new to Bitcoin, you get to start a new Bitcoin wallet. If you already have some Bitcoin, now you have a little bit more and get to try the actual Erbitz wallet. So what are we doing to help Bitcoin and advance mobile payments? So one of the problems with Bitcoin is that it's difficult. It's intimidating, can be a little bit frustrating. It's definitely unfamiliar. The usage case requires, for the most part, with real Bitcoin wallets, people having to write down a 12-word passphrase or seed. They look at these long cryptic public addresses, and you know, you have to pair devices in order to access your account, all of which definitely isn't helping the adoption of Bitcoin to the masses. You know, only a few people can really manage this. So we've built as a mobile wallet. It's on iPhone and it's on Android, and it brings about a very familiar usage case. It's simply you create an account with a username and a password and a 4-digit PIN, and that's it. Your private keys are created on the device. You have full control of them. But they're encrypted locally, they're backed up on peer-to-peer distributed servers, and live synchronized between your different devices. So your iPad and your Android phone can have the same account and have access to the same funds. And we allow people to tag the transaction with someone from their address book, someone from our built-in merchant directory, and search their transactions, things that you'd be accustomed to with regular financial software. And forgot to mention, we were nominated as one of the top 3 mobile apps in the 2014 Blockchain Awards for our merchant directory. The security model is that, like I'd mentioned, private keys are held by the user. You know, we're really, really adamant about the financial autonomy of Bitcoin, that people should control their own funds. We think that's valuable from not just an ideological point of view, but from a usability point of view. When Bitcoin gets centrally held, it can't be guaranteed to be spent because of security issues. So everything's locally encrypted. You know, for you developers, we use native C, C++ code to do the encryption password hashing, which makes it much more powerful. We actually disassociate encrypted accounts and data from the usernames and passwords that are hashed on our server. So you don't really know, even if you sent someone some Bitcoin and you knew they were on Erbitz, you wouldn't know which account to try to hack on our servers. And we use a peer-to-peer network to back up all of that data. So decentralization, we hear this word a lot, and I'm going to say it way too many times over the course of tonight, but we really, really value this. So unlike almost every other wallet, except for those that are very, very standalone on your phone, with minimal functionality, we implement a very high level of decentralization. And Bitcoin itself is decentralized, the network is, but many wallets access very central entities to get to the network. We access the network directly. Peer-to-peer nodes sitting on the network, we access directly. They're specialized nodes, but there are several of them. It's public open source, they're called LibBitcoin nodes. So we access them directly. And here's a unique thing that we do, is that our storage of encrypted data is stored on peer-to-peer distributed nodes running, actually, this software called Git. And that allows a rollback of corrupted data. But more importantly, it's peer-to-peer so that if some go down, you can still access your data. And even if all of Erbitz went down, and this is an important thing you should always ask your provider, because if we really start using Bitcoin for mobile payments, We want it to be reliable. And if all of Erbitz goes down, you can still send and receive your money because we can access the network. Really important thing. You can actually log in to your app locally with your username and password, and all that does is it decrypts the data that's already on your phone, as long as you've logged in once. So it makes us much, much, much more fault-tolerant and anti-fragile than most implementations. And with respect to ease of security, so a lot of implementations want to be secure, but I think the challenge is you have to make it easy enough for a lot of people to use and the masses to use, not just the people in this room. So we've implemented things like password recovery, and we're going to make that easier. Right now, you can get into your account using a set of questions and answers that you set up in your account in case you forget your password. It's workable, but we're going to make it even easier. And then we're launching, in a couple of weeks, a really, really cool feature we call one-touch two-factor. How many of you have a Bitcoin wallet with two-factor enabled? A handful of you. How many of you would enable it, but it's a pain in the ass? So you're lying. Okay, sure. But I have two-factor on some of my accounts, but for me, it's quite tedious. You have to copy and paste or enter the six-digit code between one app and another or your text message and another. We've built, and we're about to launch, is actually this one-touch two-factor where you just go to the settings and turn it on and forget about it. You never have to copy anything, don't have to paste anything. It's just enabled. And we do all of the functionality of a Google Authenticator app inside of the app itself. So that kind of shows how driven we are to make things usable. And things like this are where we try to drive Bitcoin and the wallet system and mobile payments to this entire ecosystem versus the legacy banking system. Cool. And that's it. Recap. Bitcoin's going to be the thing for mobile payments, if anything. Otherwise, we're probably still using credit cards. I don't foresee a lot of the other platforms that we're trying to build all that successful. And we've already been trying for 5 years. But I think Bitcoin is the one big thing. Cool. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks, Paul. So we're going to do a little fireside chat. I'm going to introduce somebody else in a minute. But before I do that, I wanted to make sure that I stop and thank the most important person in this room tonight, which is Melissa Yee, who basically put this entire event on and is our rock star for doing all of our events and outreach. So thank you, Melissa. I had nothing to do with this one, so this was all her. And also thanks to the team for moving furniture and supporting her and all of that stuff too. So so next I want to...
Usually I stand right next to the soundboard and constantly monitor it, and this never happens. I decided I'd go sit in the audience with everybody else for the presentation, and I don't know, I bet someone bumped the soundboard a little and it just made the connection go bad. The first half of the Q&A got cut off basically by this connection problem. So let's try to get back in with this question about two-factor authentication being incorporated into the Erbitz mobile wallet.
Two-factor authentication inside your app. And traditionally the problem with 2FA is that you want to distribute the access authorization across multiple devices or multiple apps. So how have you built that infrastructure to make it secure to it inside your app, saying that, say, maybe there's a vulnerability in your events?
So there's some compromises to be made with different implementations and ease of use. So our take is with a lot of two-factor authentication, especially on mobile. The definition of two factors, there's two things you need to get access to this data or to authenticate with a service. Typically, that's something that you know and then something that you have. So the thing that you know is typically your username and password, your login. And the thing that you have is that device, because that device can receive an email, that device can receive a text message with a code, that device can have an authenticating app such as Authy, which just got purchased, showing the value of two-factor. But with the advent of mobile and everyone using a mobile device, that thing you have is that mobile device, and the app that you're trying to access is also on that mobile device. But there's still a significant amount of protection, even when you're accessing both things on that same device, because that even if someone compromises your username and password, guessing it, having happen to know you, they still can't get access to your funds from a different device elsewhere on the other side of the world hacking into a server. So realize that is an incredible, incredibly huge bump up in security when you enable two-factor, even if the thing you're accessing is on the device and your two-factor is still on that device. It is still two things that you need. It's what you know and what you have. So yes, it's not split between two different devices, but so many people are using a mobile device that both are on that thing anyway. And the only way to split that is for you to log in only on a computer using your two-factor on your phone. And let's be realistic. We want to be able to access our accounts on our phone. Then you'd have to have a second token, which you, like an RSA key, which is used years ago. And I don't think a majority of the population wants to have that extra token. And to us, it's more important to give us that 90 percentile extra security, but make it nearly invisible where everyone gets it, versus that 99-100 percentile, but a lot of people don't want to use it, because then you've just lost the benefit.
Let's go right here.
Yeah, I was curious, the Bitcoin network can't handle very many transactions per second versus Visa. Since you're really looking at a payment network, how do you think that's going to change if it gets widely adopted?
So for those of you that are pretty technical, there is a new protocol that sits on top of Bitcoin using multi-signature capabilities and end-lock time. There's a great talk about it at the San Francisco Bitcoin Developers Meetup, I think just this past Monday. I recommend looking up the video if you are technical enough to understand it. It is very, very technical. But it uses point-to-point communications between the sender and the recipient. Basically, it works by sending signed transactions that don't get broadcast onto the blockchain. And so, two parties that wanted to send each other repeated transactions, many, thousands, if not millions of transactions, can do that. And then settle at the end of a specific time period, like say 3 months, 2 weeks, a year, and have only one transaction hit the network. And that could tremendously scale the blockchain and Bitcoin in general. So BitPay, being a company that's really, really interested in obviously merchant and payments, is one of the companies at the forefront of trying to implement libraries to do exactly this. A lot still has to happen, and we're years away from it being adopted onto many wallets. But it's great to see the light at the end of the tunnel, and that we're not just going to hit the ceiling and hope that things get fast enough and storage gets big enough. There really are solutions. We just have to build them out. Say again?
You didn't actually mention the name.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's payment... I'm sorry?
Peg side chains?
No, not peg side chains. This is payment channels. Payment channels, sorry. Yeah, payment channels is the name of the project or the protocol, and it's nothing new. It's actually been around since 2012. Mike Hearn had been talking about it, but a group of guys in SF are actively researching it and developing on it, and so is BitPay.
All right, let's do one more, and then I got two quick wrap-up questions for you. Let's go right here at the edge.
So I use a blockchain wallet, and I use my Cilium wallet. Why should I use... And then also, can you talk a little bit about Bitcoin and your relationship with Near and dark wallets?
All right. Awesome, and it's getting recorded. I get to talk about dark wallet and how we contribute to it and whatnot. So Arabits is most similar in its data model to blockchain.info, not so much to Mycelium. Our goal is to make it familiar, username, password, access on multiple devices. Where we differentiate from blockchain.info is that our servers don't need to be up. If blockchain is down, your wallet 100% does not function. You can't log in, you can't send, you can't receive, nothing. All of your transactions have to go through a central server at their site or distributed wherever they put it. But they're decentralized in that you hold your keys. They're centralized in the access to the network. In addition, it's weird because it's a feature, but it's a drawback. You can access your wallet on the web with blockchain.info. I will give them that credit. We did not implement a web-based access to our wallet, and we did that intentionally. Number one, if you're running a website, you have to run in a language called JavaScript, which is inherently very, very, very slow for encryption. So therefore, the encryption capabilities on the blockchain.info wallet have to cater to the lowest common denominator, which is a website. Otherwise, you'd encrypt on a mobile device and can't decrypt on a website. So we run native C, C++ code on your mobile device, compiled to the native hardware, and crank the hell up on the encryption and password hashing to a level that blockchain doesn't have. And then second, our storage is also decentralized. So access to the network is decentralized, and then so is our storage. We host peer-to-peer Git servers, for those of you that are developers. And they're 100% peer-to-peer in the sense that any number of them can go down, yet your wallet knows to just find one that's alive and send backup data to it and synchronize between your different devices. So that's what we call more distributed than decentralized, because we still run those servers. But no, nothing stops us from being able to launch a small nugget app that you can run on your computer and host a node for yourself. So it allows us to do those kind of almost kind of engineering dorky things that excite us, but you know, the masses aren't really going to do. We think that's important. So big differentiator, definitely higher encryption, much more decentralized. You can operate even if we're down. That's pretty key. So, and a lot of functionality too. At the very high level at the user interface, all your transactions can be tagged with name from your address book, category, income expense, transfer, notes. You can search your transactions from within the wallet, you know, just a text string search. And for those of you that want to be compliant, you can tag the transactions and export it and give it to your accountant. They know when you bought Bitcoin, when you sold it, when you spent it, and they can figure out the tax issues right away versus like what the heck was this transaction from 1ZF28 to, you know, 39XZW. You know, you actually can see it. It feels human. That's an important aspect of it. And I think you asked another one.
The Bitcoin, the dex kind of goes into the servers.
Yeah, LibBitcoin are the servers that we operate to access the Bitcoin network. They're open source. Other people run them. We run them as well. Our relationship with Amir is that he's the primary developer of the source code of LibBitcoin. We've contributed greatly to it. It's an alternate implementation of the Bitcoin protocol. It's still compatible with Bitcoin. It's just different code. Just like Internet Explorer and Netscape are different code that implement the browser protocol. And we actually collaborated with Amir to build Dark Market. Two of our developers joined up with Amir at the Toronto Bitcoin Hackathon, created Dark Market, and won first place. And the $20,000 prize was contributed back to Amir's group that develops LibBitcoin and some other projects as well. And that's now been forked and turned into Open Bazaar, and we're excited about that project of building a decentralized marketplace. So yeah, we're definitely down for that type of decentralized development.
All right. The beauty of having the microphone is I get the last question. Or two, quickly. So first question, you talked a little bit about if you're a merchant, the beauty of using Bitcoin is no chargebacks. If you're a consumer, right, and I buy something and it doesn't show up in the mail, it's broken, it's the wrong color, how do we get over that issue so that consumers feel comfortable about using Bitcoin and having some sort of protection?
So the issue of trust, do we trust the merchant? Right now, we don't, and we go through a central party, such as our credit card processor or PayPal, to trust the merchant. What projects like Open Bazaar are trying to do when you have an open marketplace is build trust through community trust, the way we kind of build trust over, you know, to Yelp merchants is, you know, the reviews, ratings, that type of built up trust over the entire community is, I think, where we're going to go in the future. That's what we're going to need. There are aspects of the protocol that allow us to have third-party multi-sig transactions where there can be a single arbiter, and Open Bazaar utilizes that technology. So it's not something that we need to go to a central party for. We're just going to have to get accustomed to some of these different usage cases to some degree, and we can hide a lot of that where an arbiter gets chosen when we make a purchase. We don't realize it's chosen, so it's still doable.
And final question. It's February 2016, and we're here having a meetup with Paul. What's changed since this meetup?
There's going to be people actually hanging from the window trying to watch inside because so many people are into Bitcoin, and we just can't fit in this room anymore. Nice. So if you look at the scale of what was it Micah was saying, what month and year was it when there were like a few people at the meetup?
I think it was my first meetup was probably around August of 2013. About 15 people in the park in downtown LA. Two Silk Road drug dealers. Miners and new owners trying to plug together.
Well, in that case, based on that level of scale, we'll be at, was it the Mann Theater? We'll be somewhere else in downtown LA in a major theater doing these talks. So that's probably what's changed, is we won't actually be here. Or Jim's going to be so big that you'll just have that big of an office.
Excellent. All right, with that, so we're going to wrap up here. We are going to head down to the other room, which I said is right down Abbott Kinney at 8. All right, we'll hang out for a few minutes. Melissa says we can't go to the other room yet. They don't have alcohol, apparently, till 8 p.m. So we'll go then. Paul, really great job. Really appreciate you taking time to come meet up with us and tell us about the opportunity with mobile payments and Bitcoin. Thank you.
Cool. Thanks so much, guys.
It's been really great to see active members of the LA Bitcoin Meetup Group create such amazing projects. I've been able to see the launch of GoCoin, Gem, and Airbits, just to name a few. It's amazing to see people talk about ideas and then watch the ideas become fully funded companies that really make an impact in the cryptocurrency ecosystem. Apologies for not capturing all the audio, especially to Ken Miller, who launched the Q&A with a few questions and then moderated. And just for clarity, there were actually a couple of well-attended Los Angeles Bitcoin meetups that occurred before Micah joined the group. Thank you for listening to episode 11 of The Bitcoin Game. Please let me know you listen by following or tweeting to The BTC Game on Twitter or by commenting on this episode's page on letstalkbitcoin.com. Thanks for listening.